Welcome to the monthly meeting of the Units Union of Madison. Our speaker today is Nick Schweitzer of the UW Law School and First Unitarian Society. Welcome, Nick, and thanks for coming.
It is a real privilege to be able to talk to this group about the cases in the U.S. court system over the past 90 years or so that have dealt with the teaching of evolution, and that's the topic for today, evolution in the courts. I have to say that title has two meanings, though. One is the history of evolution cases in the court system, and the second is the changes over time in the attempts to get creationism into the school system. It's an adaptation to a changing environment, which is very much like evolution itself. So, I'm going to look at seven different cases. I won't go through these. I will be going through them individually, but these are the major cases that I'll spend some time on. There are actually some other cases that raised and decided the same issues, but they mostly repeat the same questions in other jurisdictions. And that's actually where I'd like to start, jurisdiction. You may all understand this, and I apologize if I'm going over it, but if there's someone who isn't really familiar with the court system and jurisdiction, this is sort of essential to see why things happened. An important concept in the legal system and in our federal legal system is jurisdiction. And courts have jurisdiction over geographical areas. This slide summarizes, there are 50 states. Each state usually has a trial level, an appellate level, a Supreme Court level. The federal system is the same. 89 district courts, and Wisconsin has two, for example, the Eastern District and the Western District. Then there are 12 courts of appeals. One of the courts of appeals covers Illinois, Indiana, and Wisconsin. And then there is, of course, the Supreme Court. I don't know how many of you think that it is odd that it is the judicial system in a country that decides questions about teaching in the schools, but it is. And the reason, of course, is the First Amendment. This is where it really comes down every time. The First Amendment is the guarantee that Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise. And First Amendment freedoms have been extended to the states by the 14th Amendment, though that was done piecemeal after the Civil War, and it didn't automatically apply to all the states. In fact, the very first Supreme Court decision that began extending the First Amendment to states, and it was a free speech issue, not religion, was just about the time of the Scopes case. So the Scopes case was not argued on the basis of freedom of religion or the First Amendment rights. It was a basic matter of contract law. And that's where we're going to start. The very first case of note, and I'm going to spend a fair amount of time on this, is Tennessee versus John Thomas Scopes, commonly known as the Monkey Trial. It took place in the district court, the district level court in Tennessee, in Dayton, Tennessee, in 1925. We'll start with the cast of characters. This is John Thomas Scopes. I'm not sure whether he went by his first name or his middle name, as I do, so I usually say the whole thing. Just looking at his picture, I think he could be you or me, if the proper occasion were to arise. Maybe someday we'll end up being plaintiffs, or in his case, defendant, in a court case. Then there were, of course, Clarence Darrow and William Jennings Bryan. By 1925, Clarence Darrow had a formidable reputation as a defense lawyer for unpopular causes and defendants. And William Jennings Bryan had been Democratic candidate for president three times. In 1925, the state of Tennessee enacted a creationist law. It made it, anti-evolution law, unlawful to teach any theory that denies the story of the divine creation of man as taught in the Bible. And before we go on with this, I should say something about why this was happening at this time, why a number of states started enacting laws against teaching of evolution. William Jennings Bryan was one of the primary movers in that issue. He was one of the most famous and respected men in America, and he was a political progressive in almost all things political. But he was very much the driving force behind anti-evolution laws. The reasons for it, the discussion, is just covered very well in this book, Summer for the Gods. It was won the Pulitzer Prize for History in 1998, and the author, Edward Larson, earned his PhD from the UW in 1984. I want to mention one of Bryan's reasons to try and make a little more sense out of how a political progressive could have been such a religious conservative. And the phrase is social Darwinism. Not evolution, and not even just Darwinism, but social Darwinism. If you know that term, it really means survival of the fittest in human relations. And a lot of people at that time, having just gone through the First World War, felt that there was something wrong with human society, that the unimaginable devastation of the First World War was somehow related to social Darwinism. People just trying to get the upper hand without any consideration, any moral or spiritual motivation behind their actions. These are a couple of comments that Bryan made. I object to the Darwinian theory because I will feel we'll lose the consciousness of God's presence. Evolution overestimates the influence of the mind and underestimates the influence of the heart. But these in particular, a couple more quotations. Science is a magnificent material force, but it is not a teacher of morals. It can perfect machinery, but it adds no moral restraints to protect society from the misuse of the machine. And he says, but there's another objection. The Darwinian theory represents man as reaching his present perfection by the operation of the law of hate, the merciless law by which the strong crowd out and kill off the weak. So it wasn't simply what we might think of as a hidebound religious fundamentalism that went into his promotion of the Bible. It was a true concern for people and for a moral approach to interaction. He was well known for his position at the time. I don't know if this is actually portraying him, but this was included in one of his books. It's a cartoon of the time, 1924. It shows, I don't know, perhaps you can see some of the language on there. Let's see if I can do this. Science, falsely so-called, somehow bringing along the Darwinian hypothesis of evolution, leading these innocents along the path of education to disbelief in the God of the Bible. The ACLU had just begun to be active. It had only been formed a few years before, if I'm not mistaken. And they were well aware of the difficulties of these laws. And they actually issued a statement on academic freedom, basically an open invitation to anyone that said, whenever any such issue, including anti-evolution legislation, academic freedom issues, arises, those interests should write or wire the American Civil Liberties Union and aid will be furnished at once. In important cases, a representative will be sent to the scene of the trouble. So the people in Dayton, Tennessee, after the law was passed, and they knew about this declaration, decided that Dayton would be a good place for the test case. It would promote the city. In 1925, Thomas Scopes was a 24-year-old high school biology teacher. Some of the citizens in Dayton enlisted him, and he said yes. He had taught that forbidden subject in his biology class, and he agreed to the idea of being a test case. So he was not really a scapegoat or an innocent victim. He got into it of his own volition, for the best of reasons. The ACLU, in fact, enthusiastically volunteered to defend Scopes after he was indicted. And even more volunteered help came from Clarence Darrow, who was, in addition to being the most famous trial lawyer of the time, a staunch and avowed atheist. It was the only time in his life that he ever volunteered his services, and he said the case ultimately cost him about $2,000 in expenses. On the other side was the town's prosecutor, clearly outgunned, but he was soon joined by William Jennings Bryan, one of the few people in America whose reputation matched that of Clarence Darrow. Bryan had retired from politics, but he was still active in the anti-evolution crusade, and he volunteered to assist. So the case became a crusade. For Bryan, it was against atheism and agnosticism and Darwinism and evolution. For Darrow, it was against religious fanaticism. Meanwhile, Dayton filled up with tourists, hucksters, and newspapermen. Western Union installed 22 new telegraph wires in the courtroom. And one of the reasons the trial became so famous was it was the first to be broadcast live, basically. It was the first trial in which reporters were able to broadcast live over the radio, usually after they left the courtroom and spoke later. There were signs all over the town, read your Bible, God is love, where will you spend eternity, etc. The trial was held in July, and the weather was hot. You can see that reflected in the shirt sleeves that everyone sported, which were not otherwise countenanced in court. 12 jurors were chosen, 11 of which, not surprisingly, were regular churchgoers. This is a photo of Clarence Darrow making a point to somebody, possibly the jury, possibly the entire assembled multitude, which is what they were usually playing to. The trial lasted 8 days, and the deliberations lasted 9 minutes, and they returned a verdict of guilty. The judge imposed the minimum fine, $100. The conviction was appealed in the state court system to the Tennessee Supreme Court. And I want to show you some of the language that the Supreme Court used in a moment. Darrow chose not to argue a number of technical issues that could have been a basis for overturning it, hoping to get a decision by the Tennessee Supreme Court that could be elevated to the U.S. Supreme Court. To his disappointment, the Tennessee Supreme Court analyzed it primarily as a matter of contract between Scopes and the school district, and probably would have upheld the conviction, but they reversed it on the finding that the judge had made an error in imposing the $100 fine. There was a law that said all fines over $50 have to be imposed by a jury. Since the judge imposed it, they overturned the conviction and sent it back. The case could have been retried at the district level, but it wasn't. And in fact, it is of interest to look at the very last paragraph of the Tennessee Supreme Court's decision. After deciding the issue, they say, the court is informed that the plaintiff, Mr. Scopes, is no longer in the service of the state, and that's true. We see nothing to be gained by prolonging the life of this bizarre case. On the contrary, we think the peace and dignity of the state, which all criminal prosecutions are brought to redress, will be better conserved by the entry of a nolo prosequi, a decision not to prosecute, by the Attorney General. And so the Supreme Court is basically saying, we don't want to see this again. Do not retry this case. And it was not. The other interesting thing about the trial, though, is that toward the end, the Bible itself became an issue. It was an issue from the beginning. But Bryan offered himself as an expert on the Bible. And the judge allowed Darrow to cross-examine him on his qualifications as an expert. If I had more time, or this were a different class, we could talk about that whole cross-examination. I just want to show you one example. Darrow was asking Bryan those questions that we probably are familiar with about how can you believe this part of the Bible? And Bryan was coming back with answers that basically said, because I believe it. So on the one hand, you had infallible truth based on belief, and on the other, you had reason and logic. Here's the one example I'll give you. Darrow said, when you read that the whale swallowed Jonah, how do you literally interpret that? And Brian simply said, when I read that a big fish swallowed Jonah, I believe it. And I believe in a God who can make a whale and make a man and make both do as he pleases. So in my opinion, neither side made a whole lot of headway. And if you've ever been involved in any of these discussions, you may know that feeling. My personal opinion is that Darrow rather arrogantly thought that he could trip Brian up on the Bible, and although he may have thought he was scoring debating points, he basically failed to make much headway against Brian's firm beliefs. Then 5 days after the trial ended, Brian died in his sleep. His enemies said his death was brought on by the humiliation and ridicule to which Darrow's cross-examination had subjected him, but his supporters thought differently, and frankly, so do I. After all, the anti-evolution law had been upheld, Scopes had been convicted, and Brian had even magnanimously offered to pay the $100. I think Brian went to his rest knowing that he had triumphed over atheism, agnosticism, Darrow, and Darwin. Here are a couple of statements that he made in those 5 days sometime. Is the Bible true? Is the question raised by the Tennessee law? And that question is answered in the affirmative, as far as this trial can answer it. And if I should die tomorrow, I believe that on the basis of the accomplishments of the last few weeks, I could truthfully say, well done. But both sides of this issue since 1925 have basically said either Darrow won or Brian won. And there's really no answer to that. The trial became the material for a stage play in 1955 titled Inherit the Wind. Most of you are probably familiar with it. It was turned into a movie in 1960 and redone three times since then. Here's a still from the 1960s version. I could ask how many of you actually watched this, probably many. I would caution you that as with any Hollywood representation and most plays on stage, there are more than a few inaccuracies. In fact, as the authors admitted, they really just used the Scopes trial as a purpose for attacking McCarthyism. And so it was really biased in certain ways. And to appeal to a theater audience, they also invented a love interest for John Thomas Scopes, who just happened to be the daughter of the local fundamentalist minister. Added a lot of drama, but it wasn't true. Incidentally, Scopes was one of those individuals who discovered that there's a price to pay for fame, which is privacy. After the trial, he turned down offers to give lectures, to be cast in movies, to appear on the vaudeville stage. Dayton wasn't hostile to him. In fact, the school board offered to renew his teaching contract if he would just agree to obey the law in the future and stop teaching evolution. But he left, and he eventually went back to graduate school in geology at the University of Chicago. You may think I have spent an awful lot of time about a case which most of you probably already know pretty well. I do that for two reasons. First, I wanted to talk about some of the details you may not have known, some of the personalities, the aftermath, including the ruling on appeal. And second, compared to all the rest of the cases I'm going to be talking about, the Scopes monkey trial is part of popular culture. A lot of people know about it, and the name Scopes still resonates, and any discussion of the controversy usually includes references, often inaccurate, to the trial or to the movie. So knowing more about it may be useful someday. The rest of the cases I'll be talking about, up to and including Dover, are not nearly as sexy as Scopes is, and they don't have as many interesting visuals for me to show you, but they represent that evolution I mentioned before, in that they demonstrate an adaptation to a changing environment. The next case of consequence wasn't until 1968. It isn't a case that anyone knows, but I think it is really the most important. Following the Scopes trial in 1925, a number of other states, emboldened, passed anti-evolution laws, mostly in the South. The next one was Mississippi in 1926. The ACLU made a similar offer of legal assistance, but no one took them up on it. And as a general statement, the anti-evolution sentiment was much stronger in southern states than in the North. And in 1927, anti-evolution bills were introduced but went nowhere in at least 6 northern states. In fact, in Rhode Island, an anti-evolution bill was referred to the Committee on Fish and Game. And never heard of again. In 1928, however, the third anti-evolution law was passed by Arkansas, and eventually this is the one that led to the next case. Like the Tennessee law, it said, unlawful to teach the theory or doctrine that mankind ascended or descended from a lower order of animals. There were no challenges to that law, or to the similar laws in other states, including the Tennessee law that remained on the books, until 1967. Tennessee law stayed on until 1967. The challenge was in 1964, as you'll see in a moment. But there were no challenges largely because the actual teaching of evolution was really downplayed in schools for many, many decades. Until the 1960s, most biology textbooks made little or no mention of evolution, and even those that did discuss it often made the material hard to find by omitting it from the index. Then in the 1950s, the National Science Foundation funded a biological sciences curriculum study that recommended teaching the theory of evolution in high school textbooks, though a far more important factor in the change that took place in the teaching of science in the 1960s was Russia, was the launching of Sputnik in 1957. In 1964, high school biology teachers in Little Rock High School in Arkansas recommended the use of a biology textbook which contained a chapter on evolution for the next year, and the school administrators adopted the textbook. You might recognize Little Rock High School as the source of another landmark challenge to the law. It became Brown versus the Board of Education. Susan Epperson was one of the teachers who voted for the textbook, but because teaching it would cause her to break the law, she filed her suit in county court asking to nullify the law and for an injunction to prevent her from being dismissed. And this became the case of Epperson versus Arkansas, which did reach the U.S. Supreme Court. It went through 3 courts. There was a county court in Arkansas, which found that the Arkansas law was unconstitutional. That part of the First Amendment had been applied to the states by then. It was appealed to the Arkansas Supreme Court, which backed off and said it's a valid exercise of the state's power to specify school curricula, but upon appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court, the law was found to be unconstitutional as a violation of the First and 14th Amendments. The court said, the overriding fact is that Arkansas's law selects from the body of knowledge a particular segment which it proscribes for the sole reason that it is deemed to conflict with a particular religious doctrine, that is, the Book of Genesis. It is worth noting that in some of the later cases we'll look at, the courts felt that they needed to establish by hard evidence, testimony, that there was a religious purpose behind the law, that you could trace it in documents or something like that. And you'll see that especially with intelligent design. But in 1968, the U.S. Supreme Court had no trouble figuring out that the motivation behind this law was religious. Because it was a decision of the U.S. Supreme Court, it was effective throughout the United States. Consequently, it became a very strong national precedent for excluding the teaching of religious doctrine from public schools, and it effectively nullified all of those anti-evolution laws. As I said, I consider it perhaps the most important decision and precedent. Shortly afterward, the first adaptation was that several creationist organizations were established, including the Creation Research Society, the Institution for Creation Research, Creation Ministries International, Creation Science Ministries, which changed its name to Answers in Genesis about 15 years ago. How many of you actually watched Ken Ham's debate with Bill Nye 3 or 4 weeks ago? Okay, Ken Ham is the head of Answers in Genesis now. And those organizations began evolving to find ways to educate children in the biblical explanation of creation and human origins without simply prohibiting the teaching of evolution. The next case, though, is a little bit of an outlier. It attacks the issue from an entirely different quarter. Willoughby versus Stever. Willoughby was an evangelist. He brought a case in the United States District Court in 1973 and named as the first named defendant Guyford Stever, who was the director of the NSF, National Science Foundation. So, to those who accept the truth of the Bible, not only that God created the earth and everything in it in 6 days, but perhaps more importantly, that God created man in his own image, any other explanation, including the scientific one, is a false religion, almost a tool of Satan himself to spread disbelief. So Willoughby's claim was that teaching evolution violated the First Amendment because it established secular humanism as the official religion of the United States. It didn't go beyond, well, the District Court for the D.C. Circuit had no trouble figuring out that secular humanism is not exactly science, and science is not a religion. The Court of Appeals upheld that, the Supreme Court declined to review it, and so that went no farther. But the next approach is actually the movement into creationism. It was the claim that creationism is a valid theory that deserves equal time in the classroom. Once again, Tennessee had the distinction of leading the way. In Tennessee, 1973, they passed a law that said any biology textbook in the public schools which expresses an opinion of, or relates a theory about, origins or creation of man shall give equal amount of emphasis on the Genesis account in Bible. So it wasn't preventing the teaching of evolution, it just said equal time. That led to the case of Daniel V. Waters. It was filed in federal district court by a number of school teachers. The first one named Joseph Daniel. He was supported by the National Association for Biology Teachers. The first named defendant was Hugh Waters, the chairman of the Textbook Commission of the state of Tennessee. And the federal district court ruling was that the Tennessee law was a clearly defined preferential position for the biblical version of creation, etc. And for a state to seek to enforce such preference is a violation of the First Amendment. The district court was not, this decision was not appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court. Nevertheless, the opponents of evolution could see that equal time for biblical creationism was not going to be permitted. So the next adaptation was what they called creation science. In 1981, Arkansas passed a law that required the teaching of creation science along with evolution. This was model legislation that was created by the Institution for Creation Research, and the definition that was used in the case of creation science includes the following, and they call them scientific evidences for creation. Sudden creation of the universe, the insufficiency of mutation and natural selection in bringing about the development of all living kinds, changes only within fixed limits, a separate ancestry for man and apes, the occurrence of a worldwide flood to explain all of geology, and a relatively recent inception of the earth and living. The complainants in this case started with a reverend, William McLean, United Methodist minister, then other religious persons, and then, as you see, American Jewish Congress, Reformed Jews, Education Association, National Association, et cetera, et cetera. The ruling that was given in this became McLean versus Arkansas Board of Education, and the ruling that was given by the federal district court was that creation science is religion, not science. Once again, it didn't really have the trouble figuring that out. The only problem with this is it was only controlling in a limited area, and it was not appealed beyond the Eastern District of Arkansas. Finally, though, in 1987, This issue reached the Supreme Court, leading to a ruling that applied to the whole country. This one was based on the Louisiana law, which was similar, entitled the Balanced Treatment for Creation Science and Evolution Science Act, required that if evolution is taught, then creation science must be taught as well. Suit was filed in federal district court. Edwards et al. V. Aguilar et al. The first named appellant was, that was on appeal. So Aguilar, Don Aguilar, was the first plaintiff, who was a parent of a child in Louisiana public school. He was joined by other parents, teachers, and religious leaders, and in support there were amicus briefs, what we call friend of the court, just legal briefs filed by 72 Nobel-winning prize scientists, 17 state academies of science, etc. Edwards was the governor of Arkansas, and the reversal of parties is because that's on appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court. The district court said that the actual purpose of the statute was to promote the religious doctrine of creation science, and when it was appealed to the U.S. Court of Appeals, it ruled the same way, and the creationists must have thought that they had a better chance at the U.S. Supreme Court, so they appealed it to the U.S. Supreme Court. However, that court ruled the act was an unconstitutional violation of the Establishment Clause, and the ruling was 7-2. Now, I don't usually put ruling numbers in my lectures, but if you've ever been in a constitutional law class, those numbers are there. It was a ruling of 4-3, or 7-1, or something like that, because you spend a lot of time trying to figure out which justices voted which way and how they're likely to vote in the future.
Sounds like that's kind of large, at least these days, if I'm 5-6 or whatever.
7-2 is still a substantial majority, but the 2 seems to have provided some encouragement to people, and I'll sort of show you why. Justice Scalia, he was joined by Justice Rehnquist, who is now dead, but Justice Scalia is still there, and people sort of think that he may, you know, rule in their favor in the future. He basically, I won't read this whole thing to you, but Justice Scalia basically said, I think you should just teach the controversy. You know, if there are two sides of an issue, you should teach both sides. We can talk about why that's, basically the response to that is one side is not science. Teach all the sides of the scientific argument, but don't teach religion as another side. Nevertheless, Scalia being on the court is something that still provides some hope to people, I believe. But that decision, which was a U.S. Supreme Court decision, ended the attempts to teach creation science in the public schools as an alternative or along with evolution. So the proponents had to think of something else. And the next step was, of course, intelligent design. Here are a couple of definitions of intelligence design. One is by Michael Behe, who is one of their primary authors. He limits it a lot. The second one is just my own definition of it, which I think reflects more what the people argue. Behe said, intelligent design is a scientific theory that proposes that some aspects of life are best explained as a result of design, and that the strong appearance of design in life is real and not just apparent. Doesn't say much, I think. What I see in the arguments is the complexity that we observe in the natural world, at both the macro level and the micro level, especially the irreducible complexity of certain structures, is convincing evidence of design by an intelligent agent who is either unknown or at least unnamed, and not the result of an undirected process such as natural selection. That was being promoted then for a dozen years or so, and the people who were working on it, again, those same institutes, were looking for a test case. The Dover Area School District in Pennsylvania was in need of new biology textbooks, and the high school biology teachers recommended this text, Biology, Prentice Hall, which came to be referred to as the Dragonfly Book. The school board disliked the text because it discussed evolution. And in October of 2004, it chose an alternate text to be included in the classrooms as a reference work of pandas and people, which was prepared by the Foundation of Thought and Ethics. It teaches that life shows evidence of being designed by an intelligent agent. It carefully avoids mention of God or the Bible or even a divine power, merely an intelligent agent. The school board adopted the text. It actually allowed both textbooks to be in the classroom. It also created a requirement that every ninth grade science class be read a short statement that said, intelligent design is an explanation of the origin of life that differs from Darwin's view. Well, this was brought to court. Tammy Kitzmiller was the first named plaintiff of 11 parents of high school students, filed suit in federal district court seeking an injunction against the policy. This became Kitzmiller et al. Versus Dover Area School District, frequently referred to just as the Dover case. The details of the trial, the expert scientific testimony, the documentary evidence are quite interesting, and they've been put in this book, which, aside from an unfortunate title, I think they're just trying to mirror the Scopes monkey trial. Someone called a girl, monkey girl, on the playground, I believe. But aside from that, it's a good discussion of the issues and the history leading up to the trial, the personalities involved, especially the individual members of the school board, and the evidence in the case. But in 2005, the federal district court ruled that intelligent design is not science, granted the injunction, permanently barred the board from maintaining an ID policy, etc. This was not appealed. Once again, it controls legally only in the area covered by the federal district court for central Pennsylvania. A school district in another state that decides to incorporate intelligent design in its teaching curriculum will not be in violation of law in doing so, but anyone in that district can file suit. And that brings us up to almost today. The next few slides are from December, January, February, and March of this past year, last few months. It goes on. This is the fourth time I've given this presentation in about 2 months, and I have to keep updating this section because there's something new in the news almost every week. So I'm going to start here. Sorry for the text, but you may know that the approval of biology textbooks in Texas was held up all of last year because some unnamed person objected to them not being balanced. They taught evolution and they didn't teach the alternative theories. Finally, you can't even see the bottom of this slide, I'm sorry, but it's December something of 2013. The high school, the Texas biology textbook committee decided to ignore that complaint and go ahead and approve the textbook. So they are now being printed with evolution in them, and it's not a problem anymore. But that was hot news in these areas for a long time. Okay, January. In January, South Dakota, someone introduced a bill that said no school board or school administrator may prohibit a teacher from providing instruction on intelligent design or other related topics. This one I consider particularly foolish because if it's appealed, it's going to lose based on, the Pennsylvania case is not controlling, but it was extraordinarily well written and worked out, and it's going to be the same answer. So it will just be a waste of time and money for people in South Dakota. Also in January, Virginia introduced a bill. Let me read the underlined portions here. The first one sounds fine to me if you just understand the word scientific. It says, school boards are forbidden to prohibit any public elementary or secondary school teacher from helping students understand analyze, critique, and review in an objective manner the scientific strengths and scientific weaknesses of existing scientific theories covered in science classes. That's fine, as long as you don't call religion science. The motivation behind the bill, I think, is somehow captured in that last sentence, though I still can't really figure out what it means. Nothing in this section shall be construed to promote or discriminate against any religious or non-religious doctrine, promote or discriminate against a particular set of religious beliefs or non-beliefs, or promote or discriminate against religion or non-religion. You see what they're trying to do. I don't think that one's going to go anywhere. In February, Missouri basically says if the school's going to teach about evolution, parents can yank their kids out of class. It would require schools to notify parents if evolution is going to be taught and give an opportunity to remove the student from instruction. I don't know how that one will play out. And March of this year, just about a month ago, this is a bill that passed the Oklahoma House, although the last paragraph says it's probably not going to pass the Senate, so it only went that far. But it says, permit teachers to help students understand, analyze, critique, and review in an objective manner. Does that sound familiar to the Virginia one? The scientific strengths and scientific weaknesses of existing scientific theories. And when it was originally introduced, it mentioned biological evolution, chemical origins of life, global warming, human cloning, as subjects which some teachers may be unsure about how to teach. That was removed, it's been passed, it's not going to go anywhere, but these are the types of challenges that we'll continue to see. I have only one other slide to show you, and this is Wisconsin. And I have a feeling this will result in a legal challenge sometime in the next, I don't know how many months. But basically this, you know, school vouchers can be used to allow students to attend private schools, including private religious schools. And this is just evidence which someone has collected at creationistvouchers.com showing that at least half a dozen of these schools teach creationism explicitly and disavow evolution. And I think, well, I know of at least one person who's thinking seriously about bringing a legal challenge to this. So that's where the battle still stands right now. We'll see whether they're able to come up with an evolutionary change, a mutation in their language, which will pass the constitutional muster of teaching religion.
I have a question.
And it is time for questions.
Well, as you spoke, I was thinking particularly with the more recent cases of a parallel that came to my mind. And that had to do with the very gigantic issue that's before the court and the rest of us right now about whether healthcare providers may or may not provide information about contraception and abortion. I was looking, and I'm not sure with the language there, has there been a law, a proposed law or amendment that says teachers have the right to not teach something that violates their own religion? Has there ever been anything quite like that? I understand that private religious schools may choose to hire only people of that religious practice, but as far as I know, that doesn't apply to public schools.
That's an excellent question. I hadn't thought of that formulation, and I have not seen such a proposal.
Will that allow
biology teachers to not teach a subject if they don't believe in it personally?
It
doesn't make any sense.
It violates, right. Because these things are, the First Amendment is something that applies to the individual, not to the group. And that's the whole thing about the abortion issue. You know, it has nothing to do with any teachers or suppliers' particular rights. They can go to what church they please, but if they take a job as something or other, hey, they serve the public. Now, I know that's still being debated in terms of the abortion issue, but I'm just trying to think if that's apt to be next. Right now, they're putting the religious rights, putting their strength with the other issue, but
right. as I think I heard Barbara say, don't say that out loud.
Yes.
Within the confines of a secular humanist church.
Great idea, Rosemary, don't give it to them.
I have a feeling that they will come up with it all by themselves, but no hurry.
I always thought those anti-science bills that are coming up are just sort of aiming towards that myself.
Hmm. That's interesting.
I appreciate the logical process you went through to get there. I hope we don't get there. And I'm not aware of anyone having suggested that so far.
My question is you said nobody so far has taken up this challenge of the voucher schools. Has the ACLU even been considering? It seems like that's a real meat for them. The taxpayers are supporting this teaching, which is contrary to the state constitution.
My simple answer is I don't know if the ACLU knows about it. The first time I gave this lecture, which was on campus to a group of evolution students and scholars, one of them, actually, who was a retired professor, I have his name, but I don't remember it, told me about this and said he was preparing a legal brief on it. I contacted him later and said I would be glad to put him in touch with the Freedom From Religion Foundation, which would probably love it. The separation, Americans United for Separation of Church and State. I hadn't thought of the ACLU, but I actually offered to help him, and he said, well, wait until I finish my brief.
Okay.
Now, I hope he doesn't, he is not interminable, but ACLU, thank you.
Seems
I will add that to the
obvious,
list.
Yes.
It's not Don Downs, is it?
No, I don't think so.
Well, there's so many things against this whole voucher business, and that's a separate concern, but...
This may be something that will be a successful attack on it. I don't know. Any other comments, questions? Yes.
Yeah, I'm surprised you didn't bring up Kansas. Recently, well, they have elections and they vote for school board and they seem to change their mind every few years.
It's not a court case, which is why I didn't bring it up. But feel free to describe it. Go ahead.
Well, you're right. It's not a court case. It's actually an election and it's for the school board.
Yes.
And I don't know what the latest election results is, but it seems to swing every 4 years.
Right.
And where they completely want to ban any teaching of evolution whatsoever. Not only do they want to have creationism, but they want to ban evolution. What is the latest situation there?
I wish I were as up on it as you even are. I mean, I'm aware that Kansas has gone back and forth, as you say. And when a new board comes in, they entirely scrap the policies of the previous one. I don't know where it stands right now. Because I'm following, you know, legal cases rather than elections.
How come it hasn't ever gone to court?
Someone in Kansas could file a complaint. Someone who is affected by the law must file a suit.
Standing.
In fact, someone asked me a question about how can these parents file suits as in Dover rather than the high school students. I'm well familiar with the case of Ellery Shemp, who complained about the reading of the Bible, and he had to be the complainant. It couldn't be his parents. Mm-hmm. I don't know what has allowed, in many cases, the parents in this case to say, we have standing. That's an aside, because someone raised that question to me, and I honestly need to look into that. But it still leads us back to the fact that it needs to be someone probably in that school district or in that state who can say, this affects my rights. Who would bring that? So if you want to move to Kansas and file a state, or you know, if you have any friends in Kansas who aren't afraid.
How long do you have to live there?
I don't know, you probably have to be a citizen. Probably establish residency for whatever that is.
If you read the FFR newsletter, the question of standing is getting more and more difficult. It's almost like they're using it as an excuse to not hear cases.
Yes, there have been a number of cases which have been thrown, perfectly valid cases in my opinion, but thrown out on standing. They say, this person isn't really the one who's affected by this, so we're not going to decide.
Yeah, might that be a difficulty with this coming up, do you think?
With the vouchers?
Yeah.
Yes. Someone would have to find someone directly affected by it. At its widest scope, you can complain as a taxpayer that your money is being used. But sometimes that flies, sometimes it doesn't.
Has there been much investigation into the people that they call scientists? It would seem to me that we know who Nobel prize winners are, but we don't know much about the credentials that they must put forth for their intelligent design contention. Has anyone tried to, you know, examine these people and kind of hold them up to whatever they need to be held up to?
Well, it wasn't the Nobel Prize, the Nobel Peace Prize. It's irrelevant.
No, I'm talking about the others.
If they're,
no, but what did they win the prize? Was it something that they did?
It would only be relevant if they were in biological sciences. Yeah. You're right.
Some of these scientists are astronomers or
correct.
Physicists. Or they,
There are lists of, you know, 1,000 scientists who say Darwin was wrong. Mm-hmm. And I have not gone to see the lists myself. I have read in some of these books that you can find them at the sites, and they are mostly non-life science people, astronomers or engineers or just PhDs.
Geologists?
I think there are one or two there are a couple of famous geologists, but mostly I would say, if you look at those lists, they are not geologists on there.
Yeah. I'm thinking of people who deal
the
with
people like
eons.
NCSE, National Center for Science Education, also has a list of 1,000 Steves that say Darwin was right. 1,000 life sciences doctors named Steve who say Darwin was right. And by extrapolation, there's a lot more of them. It's part of the battle that goes on.
That's probably the national group that researches evolution the most.
NCSE.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think so. They're an excellent resource. Bob, you had your hand up.
On the Dover case, wasn't there evidence that came out that indicated that the Planets and People was a reworked version where they took out the term creation science and substituted intelligent design?
Lifted it.
Yeah, those of you, I didn't put the details. It's a fascinating part of that last case, and it is one of the reasons I said in more recent cases, judges have felt that they need to have hard evidence that this came out of a religious setting or that there was a religious purpose behind that. And it was eloquently shown in the Dover case because that Pandas and People textbook was presented as an intelligent design. That was the one they adopted, and there was the word intelligent design throughout that. But in discovery, they were able to get early drafts of that book. And the first draft said creation throughout it. Creationism is this. And they had just done a word replacement.
And didn't they miss a couple of
And there were one or two places where, you know, just replacing creationism with intelligent design did not make grammatical sense. But it was in there. Yes, that was part of the reason the judge had no problem figuring out. But there was a lot of evidence, really, really good evidence. The Monkey Girl book is fun to read.
Yeah,
for that reason.
There's a few other ones that are pretty good too.
Oh, sure.
Well, as a former school board member in Monroe, I've always wondered that our country is a little bit unique in the local control it gives to matters of curriculum.
Is that right?
And local individual school districts and states, whereas most countries have a national curriculum.
Yes.
You would know that better than I do, but go ahead.
But it's a philosophical question, and I don't think it's going to go anywhere because that's when we pride ourselves on our public schools being community schools and so on. But when you stop to think about the Texas State Board of Education passes on textbooks, tends to rule what appears in textbooks over the whole country because the publishers aren't going to publish a book that won't pass in Texas.
Correct. Texas, I think, is the second largest market for science textbooks.
And one, well, of course, that's one of the advantages of teaching nowadays. They rely much less on the textbooks and much more on their various other sources
other
of
resources.
Information and encouraging the students to go to the internet, which is another whole can of worms.
Yeah, that can go both ways, right? You can easily enough find teach the controversy on the internet.
Yeah.
And think that it means something. Well, you know, we're debating core standards, and that's sort of at the state level, right?
To be
implemented at the district.
Okay. Also the next generation science standards that are being developed and that have just been completed by National Science Foundation.
Okay, but those basically have to go through the states, I think. and then be adopted by local. I don't know how that position works, but it's entirely possible in my mind that states will assert more control over the decisions of individual school boards.
Well, yeah.
I don't know whether that's...
The law, of course, is national, it's passed by the
state. So some of that may become more nationalized, if that's the word.
There was, and I'm not sure there still is. Yeah, I know it's time.
We gotta go?
We have to sing it over here. There was a case, and it was in the West Coast somewhere, Oregon or someplace like that, where some people moved into a small town, and it was small enough so local control there was sort of like being in a fundamentalist situation, was such that their child could not get what they felt was a decent education. They fought it and they ultimately had to move out because local control prevailed. Apparently, legally, nothing could be done about that. I hope we can extend that to local control about what kind of people can go fracking in our land.
Well, that is an area of...
I mean, we have to be consistent,
right now. So local control can be both good and bad. Because, the local board can be taken over. Thank you for your question. Maybe this is a good time to break, and we can keep talking. Thank you.